weather, truth, and fun. We're iHub Radio, homegrown in the Coachella Valley. For a fresh take on the news with Anita Rufus, you won't know if you don't listen.
And thank you so much for tuning in. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal. I am here live on Saturdays from 10 to noon here at iHub Radio. The announcer says, and fun. And it's kind of hard to find any way to have fun these days. I do have some friends who are putting together jigsaw puzzles like crazy. There are websites that are just, you can send them a picture. They'll graft it onto a surface. They'll cut it into pieces. And you can even tell them how many pieces you want. I'll settle for maybe 150, not 1,000. And then they'll send it back to you. And it you know, could be a picture of your kid. It's a great way to spend some time. It's hard to find good news or anything to have fun with. I do have to say, a lot of my friends have been sending around videos and pictures. And you find a lot of them up on social media, Facebook. One of the best ones I got this past week that absolutely made me laugh out loud. And you know, maybe one of the best things you can do for yourself while we are going through this really incredibly stressful and difficult time is to find ways to laugh out loud once in a while. This was a great clip, and I'm not going to try and repeat the joke because it's a long joke and Buddy Hackett was way better at telling jokes than I am. But it was a clip from an old Johnny Carson show, The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, with Buddy Hackett, the old kind of round-faced, chubby, rough-voiced comedian, telling this joke. And the joke was really just hysterically funny. I laughed out loud. It broke Johnny Carson up, which wasn't all that hard to do if you used to watch the Johnny Carson show. But that's one of the ways that you can find something that relieves some of the tension, that gives you a chance to remember what it's like for something to be funny and feel good. A lot of people are watching old movies, comedy movies. Laurel and Hardy, if you've never been a fan of Laurel and Hardy, those are great to seek out because their humor was gentle and sweet. Unlike, for example, The Three Stooges, which I personally couldn't stand because the idea of slapping people around and putting pies in their face never appealed to me. Laurel and Hardy were great. And I will share with you this morning, before I get into some of the more stressful news that I want to talk about today, I will share with you, I read a wonderful statistic that is like the flip side of how down everything is right now, with schools closed and so many people having to deal with their kids being home and kids being restless and having to try and do homeschooling and the time that kids are missing with their friends and in an environment where they are learning and where parents can feel that they are safe while parents go to work. I will share with you a statistic that it's a good statistic, but it's also something that gives you a moment of pause. And that is that the month of March, we're now in April, today is April 18th, but the month of March was the first time in 18 years there we have not had one school shooting. So I said, you know, there's a downside to that piece of good news, but think about that for a minute. The society we live in, that it is because students are not in schools that March of 2020 was the first time in 18 years that we did not experience a school shooting. I sent out a blast this week that I do this every week. I have a big mailing list, and I'll be happy to put you on the mailing list. All you have to do is send me an email. You can just send it to anita@lovableliberal.com and tell me you'd like to be put on the list. Nobody sees the email addresses but me. But it's kind of a teaser every week, and I want to share with you the teaser I sent out this week, because this is where my head is right now. With all the news going on, and I'll get into some of it, and I'll give you my analysis, or I'll give you a point of view you may not have thought of. But here was my blast this week. Are lives expendable in the name of restoring the economy? And this is an argument that's going on out there a lot. And there are some people I don't particularly have a lot of respect for, but nevertheless, there are some people out there, people in high positions, people who are well known, including elected officials, who are saying, well, hey, you know, if it means getting the economy back up and running, okay, so some people are going to die, mostly old people, maybe some children. And so my question was, are lives expendable in the name of restoring the economy? And then I asked, weren't some lives already considered expendable? Which to me is an even bigger question than recovering from this virus. And that is, if you look at the statistics of what's going on out there, the number of people of color who are dying in percentages of the that are way beyond their percentage of the population. So weren't we already considering some lives expendable and not making sure that everybody had access to decent health care, so that some of these underlying conditions like diabetes or heart disease could at least have been being treated because people had access to the healthcare system? My next question, are we all in this together? Or are we so divided that being rational no longer matters? I'm a left brain person. I'm not artistic. I'm not one of those people who sees things in shapes or visual concepts. When I dream, I don't dream in shapes or abstracts. I'm a left brain person. I dream in movies. I dream in stories. Sometimes I hate having to wake up because I was not at the end of the story yet. I believe in rational thought. I believe that sequential thinking is important to learn. This is one of the things we want our children to learn when they are in school. How do you go from one thing to the next logical progression so that you can get to the point where you understand something, or where you understand enough to be able to question something? Does being rational no longer matter? Aren't we all in this together? Or are we so divided that it becomes, if you're for that, I'm against it, which is not rational at all. And the other question, final question that I asked in my blast this week, what are we learning about ourselves and our own values? What arguments do you buy into? And what does that say about what you value and who you are? There are bigger questions that we need to be asking other than, well, how soon can I go out to a restaurant? Hey, I'm real frustrated that I can't go to the movies, or that I can't go out and, you know, have a nice meal at a place I like. There are bigger questions in what we're dealing with right now. Fear is very much present throughout the world right now with regard to this virus. And yet there are some of us, even in the United States, who live with fear all the time. young people growing up in neighborhoods where there is rampant crime, or where if you don't belong to a gang, for example, in a Central American country, if you don't belong to a gang, your family is at risk. And that's one of the reasons so many people are trying to get here and ask for asylum, because their families are at risk. And there are times when government matters. We are 50 separate states, and each state has its own state government, and we are seeing how effective some governors have to be. And they have to be responsive to the people they represent. They are elected to represent people. But there are times when we can't be left just to our own resources. There are times when government matters because it's more than just what's happening in your tiny town or your small city or your big city or your state. It's what's happening because we have freedom of travel from one place to another. And what are we taking with us when we go across a state line or into another community? When government matters, it's important that we be able to believe that that government is effective. Obviously, we still want our government to be respectful of us as individuals. It is one of the key things that defines who we are as Americans. But what do we owe each other when we are at risk, when we are living in a time of danger? Now, in order to be protected from this virus, we have been kind of willingly surrendering some of our basic rights, including the freedom to leave our own homes. And there are some people who are rebelling against that because they're saying, hey, look, I looked up and down my street. Nobody's sick on my street. Why can't we all, you know, have a block party and at least be around each other again? But the fact is, this virus has made government important again. The realization that we're not all in this individually. We're all in this together. Now, we have different circumstances in various places around our country. But government is not just powerful again or important again. It's vital. We have to have a sense of leadership, a belief that those who we have elected to lead us are getting as much information as they can from as many smart, talented, experienced people as they can find, and then making rational decisions in the best interest of all of us. And today, we really do understand. Good government makes a difference today between whether we might live or die. That's nothing to take lightly. Who will we be after this virus? This is Anita Rufus. This is iHub Radio.
Live from Palm Springs, she calls it as she sees it. Local talk that's moving the needle. Here's Anita Rufus on iHub Radio.
And again, I thank you so much for joining me live on Saturdays from 10 to noon here at iHub Radio. Phone number here is 760-544-8255. You can text 760-699-0202. Or you can email a question or a comment, studio@ihubradio.com. But the phone number is 760-544-8255. Brian's on the board today, and he will take your call. And if you're relatively sober and remotely on topic, we'll put you on the air. So I'm asking, who will we be after this virus is over? And how will we evaluate ourselves for how we got through it and what we end up doing as we come through this. And I have no doubt we will come through this. This too shall end. And hopefully sooner rather than later. A guy named Ed Young, who is an editorial column writer, he wrote a column called How the Pandemic Will End. And one of the things he said that kind of caught my attention, he said, pandemics can catalyze social change. People, businesses, institutions have been remarkably quick to adapt or call for practices that they might once have dragged their heels on, like working from home, conference calling to accommodate people who can't get into a central place to make it to a meeting, providing sick leave for all employees, flexible childcare arrangements. There are people who have kids who have to work, and we do not provide good childcare alternatives in this country. And I have talked in the past about one of the childcare systems that I have been most impressed with in the world is one that I found out about in France, where from preschool through after school, all the years a kid is growing up, there is state-sponsored licensed childcare with trained teachers and overseers. And every child is free to attend, and how much it costs is based on what you can afford. And if you can't afford anything, it doesn't matter. Your kids can get in there anyway. So in a New York editorial in the New York Times, a writer named James Bennett wrote, "This pandemic offers the same opportunity that Americans have seized during past crises to set aside petty differences, to recognize national priorities, and to set to work again on creating a more perfect union," which is the goal that we are all brought up on. And anyone, again, who is willing to engage in rational thinking knows that we have never quite fulfilled that promise to ourselves. Okay, so how are people handling having to stay at home and work from home or not be working at all? There's a poll that has been kind of cataloging these questions every week since the stay-at-home began, well over a month now. And the truth is that this virus is not affecting all of us evenly. For example, if you feel stuck at home, guess where ultra-rich people are staying at home? Many of them escaped wherever they live to work because they're not working, except maybe from home. And they've escaped to vacation homes. One billionaire rented a huge, incredible yacht and is sitting out there in the ocean with all kinds of supplies being delivered by helicopter when they run out of food or booze. He and his family are just having a fine time right now. There are ultra-rich people who are renting big mansions out in the middle of nowhere because they can. Most of us don't have that luxury. In fact, this poll found that almost 60% of those who have to go to work every day, people in markets who are getting the virus at higher levels than people staying home, people who are doing service jobs, truck drivers, food service industry, 50% of those who are still leaving the home to work say that they feel that doing their job is risky, compared with only 13% of those who are working from home who feel like they're at risk. African Americans, 50% of African Americans and 47% of Hispanics are more likely to see their work as risky. And 20% of Americans are now saying they know someone who has tested as positive. And as many as 4 in 5, 80%, worry about getting sick themselves. Democrats, older Americans, and women are more likely to say that they're wearing masks at least some of the time, if not all of the time. Don't Republicans think they need to worry too? This is Anita Rufus. This is iHub Radio.
News, weather, and a couple of dozen loudmouths. This is iHub Radio. She calls it as she sees it. Now, here's Anita Rufus.
And again, I thank you for joining me. I'm talking about this poll that was done about the wearing of masks. Some states are requiring, or even some cities are requiring, that if you go outside your house, you need to be wearing a mask. Not just because you may be in an infectious state and not even know it, because it turns out that before you even show symptoms of the virus, you can be passing it, but because you want to protect yourself from somebody else who might be in that state, who's walking down the street past you. But I found one thing really interesting about this, and that is, and this is counterintuitive, people who are still working outside their homes, grocery clerks, delivery people, food service people, people who still have to go to work and are going to work, are less likely than those who are working at home to be wearing a mask. And when I say counterintuitive, if I had a business, given the current circumstances, and I was able to actually still be open, like a market, I would make sure that as every employee came to work, they were given a mask. I wouldn't depend on them having their own. It's the least I could do to protect my workers and my customers. Now, I'm a big fan of words. I find words fascinating. And so I'm always looking for examples of really brilliant use of the language. And I found a wonderful example of that. It was a column written by a woman named Jennifer Senior. And she was writing about Trump's management style, if you can call it that. He has a style. I'm not sure it has anything really to do with management. But she said, since the early days of the Trump administration, an impassioned group of mental health professionals have warned the public about the president's cramped and disordered mind. And she describes it as a darkened attic of fluttering bats. I think that's brilliant use of the language. And speaking of bats, that brings me to another thing, and that is the conspiracy theories about where this virus came from. And there are some people who just absolutely love getting into conspiracy theories. So it turns out this week, a study was released which found that the risk of transmission from surfaces outdoors is lower during daylight. That the virus doesn't do as well under higher temperature and humidity conditions. I suppose that bodes well for the state of Florida. It doesn't hurt us here in the desert, as we're predicted to get up to 96 by Wednesday, which for us, given that it's not very humid, is really not that hot. But apparently, according to this study, sunlight destroys the virus quickly. So the president's posit a couple months ago about, oh, well, as the weather warms, it'll disappear. Well, it's not going to disappear because the weather warms, because there's a whole lot of places in this country that don't get real hot. But it is good to know that sunlight is now found to destroy this virus quicker than they had thought. So it does still adhere to certain kinds of surfaces for anywhere from a couple of hours to a couple of days or longer. Maybe we just need to put everything out in the sun. Nevertheless, the virus is expected to linger throughout the summer. But one of the conspiracy theories was about the fact that it may have come from bats. They talked a lot about what they call the wet market in Wuhan, China, which is where some of the first cases were found. And in Wuhan, they have these wet markets where they literally chop up live animals and people make soup out of them or whatever, talk about getting fresh meat. Well, there was some talk about the fact that it may have come from bats and that people were eating bats. The other theory is that there's a lab not far from where the wet market is in Wuhan, and that lab may have been playing around with putting together a virus for chemical or biological warfare purposes, and that they were making that virus based on it coming in some way from these bats, and that a worker there got infected and gave it to others, and that's where it all started. And this is a theory that a lot of people on the right are now throwing around, because anything that would make it look like China did this on purpose would certainly be wonderful for their philosophies. But I'm thinking, well, if it doesn't do well in sunlight, maybe it did come from bats. They don't do well in sunlight either. However, one of our top generals, United States top general, says evidence that the coronavirus originated at a Chinese lab is inconclusive. And this is following a report that U.S. officials warned of some safety concerns at that research facility in Wuhan a couple years ago. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley, told reporters that it is inconclusive. Although the weight of the evidence seems to indicate natural cause. So there's a whole lot of scientists who have been studying this virus, pulling it apart, trying to understand what formed it, what caused it, what kind of mutations it is capable of in order to survive, so that they can figure out how to find a vaccine that would get rid of it. And so far, in spite of this conspiracy theory, so far, their research seems to indicate that this virus was not man-made. So I want to say that again, because when your friends throw those conspiracy theories at you about the bats and the lab in Wuhan, and there's another theory, by the way, that the Chinese had, which is that this originally came from a lab somewhere in the United States that had a Chinese worker who was from Wuhan, who returned home to Wuhan from the lab here in the United States and brought it with her. Neither of those theories has proven out, but they're great conspiracies. But the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States said it is inconclusive, although the weight of the evidence seems to indicate natural cause, that this virus was not man-made. Then Then, of course, there's the theory, as I said, about this having come from a United States lab where they were working on biological weapons. And hey, bottom line for me, I don't care how it got here. It's here. Someday we might figure out and there'll be all kinds of investigations and people will do whatever work they do to try and figure out what happened. But I don't care how it got here. It's here. And we need to survive it. And we need, in my view, to figure out what we can learn from the experience. So meanwhile, we're having all these conversations about how to reopen the government and reopen the economy. And while the president has talked about letting states reopen based on their own timetable, many of the states this past week, several states and Washington, D.C., this past Tuesday, reported their deadliest days dealing with this virus. New Jersey, the state with the second highest number of cases behind New York, had the worst day. They had over 4,000 new cases of the virus as of Tuesday and 365 new deaths. Louisiana, Washington, D.C., Maryland, so you ask yourself, if we know that these kinds of fatalities are happening and that there are some states like California that have, as they say, flattened the curve, that new cases are diminishing, fewer people are having to be hospitalized, fewer still having to be intubated and put on ventilators, most of whom, 80 to 85% of whom, will die. If that's the reality, how does reopening our economy become a partisan issue? We all want to get back to a functioning economy. There are those on the right who say, well, you know, the liberals, they want to shut it all down so that they can make sure that government's going to take over everything. That's just hogwash. Liberals own small businesses too. Get over yourself. But how does reopening become partisan? Republicans are increasingly eager to get businesses reopened and customers into their doors, because they say that a prolonged economic shutdown will do more harm to our long-term viability than the virus itself. Now, that's a message that is not in line with what the president is hearing, what we're all hearing from the public health professionals. And don't lose sight of the fact that for both the president and his most ardent supporters, the economy was what he thought would propel him straight back into the White House for four more years. And Republicans believe that it is critical to their own electoral victories in November. And November is not that far away if you think about it. When we come back, I want to talk about California and how much California's action under Governor Newsom, like him or not, he has gotten positive results as a result of the policies that we are following here in California. Is it time to reopen even a little bit here? Maybe. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal, and you are listening to iHub Radio. Thank you.
because you only think you know the truth. Striking blows against the corporate talk radio monolith in the Coachella Valley. iHub Radio. Participation encouraged, but not required. Here's Anita Rufus.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about how California's actions, because we're in California, although some of you are listening from other places. But I want to talk about how Governor Newsom and California's actions, not just at the state level, but in individual counties and communities, have made a difference. And one way to get a sense of how to put that in perspective, you know that I keep track of the changes in these numbers 1 week to the next. And as much as we may feel like things are settling down, you know, Italy seems to have leveled out their curve, France is doing better, Germany is doing quite well, Sweden claims they're doing fine in spite of the fact that they haven't done any stay at home, but they do have deaths going up there. China's kind of leveled out. Japan thought they were doing great, but some of their numbers are going up again. The worldwide numbers in 1 week, and these are just cases that we can report based on testing. And in our country, in spite of the fact that the president keeps bragging about how many tests we've done, more tests than anyone in the world, we've only tested about 1% of our population. 1%. So we don't really know how many people are infected. But in general, based on the reporting we can focus on, last Sunday, the worldwide figure was about 1,800,000. As of this morning, it's 2,800,000. So in the last 7 days, the number of reported cases worldwide has gone up by at least 1 million. And deaths worldwide, last week it was 110,000. This morning it's 156,000. So 56,000 reported deaths in the last week. In the United States, as much as it feels like it's getting better, especially to those of us sitting here in California, a week ago in the United States, we were reporting 530,000 cases. As of this morning, it's 707,000. That's almost 200,000 more reported cases in the last week. And deaths in the United States, 20,600 as of a week ago, 37,000 as of this morning. That's starting to get close to a 100% increase in a period of 7 days. It is a sobering thing to realize when you also see how much action there is to try and get things reopened. It's time. Now, California's early action paid off in lower death numbers. This past Wednesday, California was projected to reach its peak of deaths from the virus with an estimated 66 deaths. By comparison, as of this past Wednesday, New York State had nearly 800 deaths. This is a huge difference that speaks well to the action that California took early on with stay-at-home orders. Our stay-at-home order was enacted by Governor Newsom on March 19th, 1 month ago. New York's order didn't come until 3 days later. And even that difference in the amount of time has made a huge difference in the number of those afflicted and those dying. Now, Governor Newsom has a plan for reopening. Originally, some of the states got together and grouped themselves. There's a group in the West, California, Oregon, and Washington State. There was an Eastern group, New York, Connecticut, Delaware, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and then a Midwest group started up this past week. Because the president made clear he wasn't going to take responsibility for a nationwide approach, at least not until he announced his phased program, which nobody fully understands, including the president. But this idea for groups of states where it is presumed that there's a lot of across state line travel is a way to try and contain this as much as possible. And now Governor Newsom has put together a task force in California to focus on a plan to move us toward opening up the economy with a specifically defined focus on inclusion. Because if we're going to try and fix the things that we know contributed to how dastardly, how dire this program is, it also includes that we have to pay attention to the fact that there are some neighborhoods, some areas, some populations that have not been included and that have been hurt more than other areas or other groups of people, even in this wonderful liberal state of California. So he's put together an 80-member task force, which includes the four former living California governors. Pete Wilson, a Republican, Gray Davis, a Democrat, Arnold Schwarzenegger, a Republican, Jerry Brown, a Democrat, and he's also included business people, tribal leaders, lots of people who have been involved in social justice issues, and they are all going to get together to inform these new policies that are focused both on growth of the economy in California and inclusion. And you know, putting that into a mission statement means that at least it will get considered with every decision that is made. Are we living up to our mission, not just to get us out of this mess, but to make sure we're inclusive? Governor Newsom is also going to have the state grant at least 2 weeks of paid leave for food sector workers, farmers, delivery drivers, the people who grow and pick and pack and deliver and cook and serve and sell our food. So that if they get the virus, or if a quarantine prohibits them from going to work, they'll get at least 2 weeks of paid leave. It's about time somebody thought of doing that for those who are the most disadvantaged. Okay, I'll share with you the criteria for reopening.